Welcome, listeners. You're here with Chuck Indereeden in Fairbanks, Alaska. Great studio here at KFAR. You're listening to us at 97.5, 660 AM. Remember, you can always go to our archives at kfarradio.com. Click on that little link that says Shooter's Corner with Chuck Indereeden. Scroll down past my bio, and there's the archives. Imagine that. Teresa does an excellent job keeping those updated for us, so anytime you can go there and listen to our past shows if you've ever missed one. Remember, you can also go to the KFAR Radio app on Apple or Android and listen to the show live from anywhere in the world as long as you have an internet connection. It's amazing. I know. Today's guest we have with us, as always, we have Matt is with us. Miss Boise Bell's out just for the day, and then we have our special guest, Colonel Montana Kid Hammer. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, always. Always is. All right, so here's what we're going to talk about today, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to talk about the BAR and compare it to the MG-42, because they kind of had to meet each other on the battlefield at one time, didn't they?
Absolutely. More than we could appreciate.
Yeah, exactly. So before we start into that, let's start with our show, as always, with a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. All right. Awesome. Let's talk. So the Browning automatic rifle, the BAR, officially known as the M1918.
Correct.
And the German Maschinengewehr, right?
Correct.
The machine gun of war, the MG-42, were both iconic automatic weapons in the World War, serving as key fire support weapons for infantry squads. So these were literally infantry squad weapons.
Yeah, squad on squad, yeah.
Squad on squad. The BAR, designed by John Browning in 1917. That dude made a lot of really cool stuff. You know, just the 1911, but the machine guns, the...
He had his forerunners to the 1911. He had the potato digger in 1895.
What?
It was called a potato digger because it would, the way the cycle, action would cycle, if you had it close to the ground, it would dig the dirt. Look it up.
I will.
And so, you know, we have his early pistols from, you know, late 1897, and all. Then he goes into the 02s, the 03s, some variants on 05s. I carry an 08. And
do you have a potato digger?
Oh, I wish.
So I'm kind of like stuck on that because I'm from Idaho.
Yeah. And I would like to have a potato digger, but I try to stay out of guards wherever possible because I have a brown thumb and stuff. So I kill things, kill plants. But by the time we get to the 1911, of course, you know, John Browning has a number of Winchester lever rifles prior to, you know, to the 20th century. But yes, he has the 1917 belt-fed, water-cooled machine gun. In fact, the government adopted.
Now, that wasn't the Lewis, though. That was British one, right? What do we call ours then? Just the 1917?
Yeah, it was a 1917.
Water-cooled as well.
In fact, the government had procured both of those firearms, the BAR and the 1917 belt-fed water-cooled guns, but the government didn't want to have a confusion. So though the BAR is being manufactured in 1917, it will be called the 1918. And initially, it's not called the Browning Automatic Rifle, although it gets some of that. It's called the Browning Machine Rifle. What's really the difference? And in John Browning's mind, it's what it would do. And as we go through the hour, we will look at some of the variation on that. But yes, and the other thing, too, was that we think of, in hindsight, we think of John Browning as, you know, the most prolific firearms maker in the world, and that can be debated, but it's not too far off the mark. He's not known like that until the Browning Automatic Rifle or the Browning Machine Rifle comes out. That's when he gets this notoriety that somehow has eluded him the whole way, you know, and he's, you know, manufacturing firearms in Europe with FN and and so on and so forth. So John Browning is given the, you know, an outline for developing what we will call the BAR. And he's not thinking walking fire. He's not thinking squad automatic rifle necessarily. He is making this really phenomenal machine that in time, particularly, I like to blame the Marines for the success of this firearm, but, you know, the U.S. military, to include the Navy and the Coast Guard, have them as such, and they find very marvelous ways to put them to use. And so, you know, thank you, John Browning, and that's where he gets his, you know, his accolades as such. And how many of them were made? Well, my notes say there were 351,500-ish, probably a bit more.
Right.
And that might not count everything that might have been made in licensing or unlicensing as such. So the firearm really comes in to its own. It's from the French tactic, and precisely I couldn't locate when the French developed, you know, this walking fire technique. Obviously not in 1914. They didn't quite have their trenches going on.
Hold on. You said the French developed a technique?
Yes.
Huh.
And we
is that an oxymoron?
And we can talk about it in public.
I don't know. Retreat and surrender worked out pretty well for them.
Pretty much. I thought that was their technique.
That's their only ones they got.
Or let's build something and then, like, watch the Germans go around it, like the Maginot Line.
Yeah, there we go. And because Pershing, General Pershing, who actually has the Browning machine rifle or the BAR in theater in 1917, but he's afraid the war is going to last maybe until 19 or 20, so he's very afraid to let that rifle be captured by the Germans. So only in approximately the last 6 or 8 weeks of that war, the end of September, early October, does this rifle start to show up on the battlefield. And so the walking fire technique, and I do have the cartridge belt with the cup to carry the rifle in for walking fire, never really takes off. And so in a sense, the federal government, or the Department of the, it wasn't
Department of War.
Yeah, Department of War, says this gun didn't really meet our expectations. Well, it hadn't actually been utilized in any capacity, although it is rumored that Val Browning, the young son of John Browning, was the first soldier to use it in combat in Europe. And while I can believe that, I just can't substantiate that because I haven't gone through the Army archives, and his records probably weren't burned up in St. Louis.
Yeah, like everybody else's were.
Yeah. So, again, the BAR with the War Department gets a bit of a rap because it didn't deliver, and we're kind of going like it didn't hardly get there. So
only because Pershing was kind of like blocking it, so it wouldn't be actually stolen by the Germans.
Yeah, he was
as well.
Husbanding it.
So what was the equivalent that the Germans had then at that time? Then maybe just another water cooled, like it set in place machine gun.
Yes.
It didn't have the capability of being carried, because the Browning at that time was only weighing like 16 to 19 pounds with a bipod.
Yeah, well, yeah.
A lot of their machine guns are in the 25, 30-pound range.
Yeah. Your BAR was 15.8 pounds without the handle, without the bipod, and without an extra bit of barrel length that would, and it's not even a full inch and all. And again, the 1917 is what the Americans, which – nearly 50 pounds, but you got to lug around with the ammo and the bipod and stuff. And honestly, I don't know that the BAR has a competitor quite yet. And again, because it was called a Browning machine rifle,
it was
like our M1 Grand would become, except it was box magazine fed with 20 rounds. Although initially they said break them in with 18 rounds, break them in with 19 rounds. But as they break in, then carry them as such. And people complain, well, but he had to have an assistant and a second assistant, the gunner, the BAR gunner, and all. And I'm going, if I remember right, as a young teen watching the Vietnam War go on, I watch almost every guy in a platoon or in a squad moving, what are they draped in? You know, it's not laser
Box magazines.
Hawaii. Yeah.
Okay, that's awesome. So we're going to continue on this conversation when we come back from this break in talking about the Browning machine
rifle
versus the Browning automatic rifle. And we'll continue on this compare and contrast with that in the MG42. We'll be right back after this break with Chuck, Matt, and Colonel Montana Kid Hammer here at Shooter's Corner. Welcome back, listeners. You're here with Chuck Indereeden at Shooter's Corner here in the great city of Fairbanks, Alaska. Staying warm here in the KFAR studios. Perfect day. But nonetheless, we have our special guest with us, Colonel Montana Kid Hammer. And as always, we have Matt. Miss Boise Bell's out doing stuff. So, nonetheless, we were talking about the BAR and the comparisons with that in the MG42. Because although the BAR, the Browning Automatic Rifle, or the Browning Machine Rifle, Machine Gun Rifle, started out in 1917, they eventually met each other around 1942. So, when the MG42 was finally developed, and then, what was it, Colonel, put into action probably around 43, maybe? 44?
More so. And how much of it went to the western or to the eastern
front, side?
I don't know. But I'm going to guess initially they started to develop there because that was a place that Hitler really wanted in his back pocket.
Right. But we do know that they were at the Battle of the Hürtgen Forest for sure. They were definitely in the Ardennes that's how I think it's where it got its nickname from the Americans, being Hitler's buzzsaw.
Yeah, buzzsaw. No
question. One of those hard words in the morning.
Not that the MG34 was anything to sneeze at, but yes, we meet this very upgunned MG34.
Okay. One of the things we were talking about on the break, though, was does the does the BAR fire from the open or closed bolt position? We were having an interesting conversation about that because you had alluded to there's a difference between the model that fired from the closed bolt versus from the open bolt.
Okay.
Yes. Why don't you take us through that?
As one of the iterations of the BAR, it was strictly a semi-automatic firearm. Now, what Ohio Ordnance Works is doing is called an A3, and it fires from a closed bolt where everything else was open bolt. Now, I had an opportunity to train, practice, and own the open bolt version. Which, as you can imagine, when you let off the trigger, it goes to open bolt. You can change magazines easily enough, and then when you're ready, get back on the trigger. In the modern iteration, closed bolt, I have an adapter that goes in my magazine. I put it in the firearm, and then I can open the bolt. That way we can inspect it, look at it. But as soon as I pull that magazine, the bolt goes closed.
Forward.
Goes forward. Then I go ahead and put whatever ammunition I want from my 20-round or whatever I put in my 20-round mag. There are 40-round mags, although I've never met one. And then you have to cycle the bolt, and then one shot. So, of course, I cut my teeth on the select fire rifle, so working with the semi-automatic is it's a new learning curve.
Let's break this down, though. So when the Browning was originally designed in 1917, was it automatic?
Yes.
Was it firing from open or closed bolt?
Open bolt.
Got it. And I'll explain why I think that's important that the listeners understand the distinct differences on that. But this Ohio ordinance one that you have or you've seen is firing from the closed bolt position, but it is only semi-automatic.
It is only semi-automatic.
Yeah, because a lot of people don't know this, you do not want to have a closed bolt machine gun firing at combat sustained rates because the barrel's going to heat up, the chamber's going to heat up, and now you're going to have a runaway gun with cook-offs.
Not only that, the NFA made it illegal for you to own open bolt firearms.
Oh, thank you. They took all the fun out of that.
Yeah, really ruined that. They said
because of the fact that they're exclusively machine guns?
Yeah, the whole reasoning behind it is they assume that because machine guns are open bolt, if you have an open bolt firearm that's semi-automatic, it can be easily converted to a machine
gun.
That was their whole thing. So stupid.
Yeah, you can put an FRT in it easier.
Yeah, yeah.
Imagine that. But yeah, I think it's important that people know that, hey, machine guns typically, at least military grade, mm-hmm. fire from an open bolt position, meaning when you pull the trigger, now the bolt goes forward and fires the round and then continues the cycle as long as you're holding the trigger down.
Correct.
Versus firing and then extracting, ejecting, and then loading a new round.
Yeah. You know, and that is, you know, good to know. I changed some furniture with one. One of the things I could do is the magazine well is actually the A2 version, so it made it easier for soldiers to get magazines in. I am researching about changing that, but it might run into some issues. But one of the nice things with NFA and all of that is that there's a like my gas system, my barrels, if they're A2s, they'll fit on an A3.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to do any special stamps, tax at all. But again, what you can't do with the A3 is anything with the trigger group. Yeah, you can, but face the consequences.
right.
And all. For me at age 70, I kind of like the ka-chug-a-dee-ka-chug. It goes when I want it to go as opposed to when I was 35. And, you know, the model I had then was, like I said, you asked if it was automatic. You could get them that selected semi-auto mm-hmm. and full auto. The one I had selected about 300, 350, or it would select 550, 600. And I got it because it was the one I could get and so on and so forth.
That's cool.
And again, there's so many variations. We'll talk about a book a little later on that if you've got $250, you will learn everything you would ever want to know. Although I understand Lieutenant Ballou was actually working on a follow-up book when he passed away, and nobody's followed up. But I don't know what more we could know, but it's a fascinating firearm, chambered in .30-06 Springfield, although it was, you know, our allies chambered in .303 British and other, but we utilized the .30-06 Springfield, which when you think about the German cartridge stuff, it's not necessarily the longest, biggest, necessarily the most powerful, but it is still exceedingly effective as such. So yes, open bolt in your semi-automatic or in your full automatics or select fires, and close bolt in your semi-automatics.
So both of these machine guns, I thought it was interesting. You said it earlier that there was walking fire. We know that wasn't happening with the MG42 just because of the weight, but when I was in, walking fire might have a different meaning than what it meant during World War I. So when you say walking fire during World War I, we're talking about picking up the gun and walking towards your enemy and firing at the same time, simultaneously.
Correct.
Right. Versus walking fire to me is taking my tracers and walking them onto my target.
Yep.
I mean, that's kind of how I viewed the world as a modern infantryman, if you want to call it that. Okay. So there's a clear distinction between the two different tactics, if you will.
Precisely.
Right. Yeah. I thought what's interesting is also the calibers. So the BAR was a .30-06, so 7.62x63. Mm-hmm. The MG42 was shooting a 7.92x57 Mauser. So that's pretty cool.
That I did not know.
Yeah, so the weight of, we already talked about the weight, you said like normally about 15 pounds up to maybe 19 pounds for a BAR, but the MG42 is 25.6 with a bipod.
Wow.
So think about it. I mean, I remember having the M60 machine gun, and that was definitely a pig that you didn't want to freaking carry around all the time, so you had a small tripod for it with a T&E, a traversing and elevation mechanism, obviously. But here's the distinct difference, rate of fire.
Mm-hmm.
Right, rate of fire for the BAR was 500 to 650 rounds per minute, 300 to 450 with reduced rate on the A2. Probably to what help that barrel wear.
Yeah,
and then the MG42, 1200 to 1500 rounds per minute. Practical was about 150 rounds per minute. But you could change the barrels like instantly on that gun system as well.
Yeah, I think that's what made it very just a bigger threat, because you think, okay, well, they're shooting really fast. They probably are going to have to give it a second to cool down, reload, whatever, and then it just picks back up. Mm-hmm. Like it was nothing.
Just swap a barrel.
Yeah. I can't imagine
being. Disassemble, you don't even have to take it off the tripod.
Yeah, being the first, of our forces to go against that. And you're like, why are the barrels come out on this? Oh, to cool it down. They're not filling it with water or pee.
Because
like
the, both of them are air cooled.
Yeah.
So.
Right.
Effective range of the BAR, well, actually the feed system, 20-round detachable box magazine. I can imagine like walking across the field and shooting that thing and then leaving a, like a, what, Hansel and Gretel, like, freaking line of box mags. Yeah, breadcrumb trail, and then your freaking Joe's back there like, I don't know, who's reloading these box mags for me? Versus belt-fed, non-disintegrating links, right, in 50-round belts for the MG42. So, were those the cloth belts? Do you know if they were using the cloth belts on the MG42?
I want to believe that initially,
I think they were.
Yeah, they started out with them. Of course, you know, the problems that Germans would have is past the time you've got, you know, you're running out of resources.
Sure.
You've got to make them out of anything that, you know, within reason. And
so what you're saying is they were later made out of nylons?
Well, and again, disintegratable links, you know, especially if you stay someplace, you can gather them up, relink them. Mm-hmm. Of course, again, if you can hang on to your cloth belts, you can restuff them, which right. I mean...
I would say the cloth belts would probably be faster to stuff than the relinking.
Actually,
because I've relinked stuff with the M60 and
that's awful. I hate relinking rounds or even delinking them. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So actually, they were held together with metal links.
Oh. Well, there you have it. Non-disintegrating metal links, though.
Yep.
So that actually is better, I would say, then.
Non-disintegrating, much better.
Yeah, it's kind of like a chain, then. You just shove rounds into it. Yeah. Effective range for the BAR was 100 to 1,500 meters, and then the MG42 was 200 to 2,000 meters, up to 3,500 meters with optics and a tripod.
Jeez.
Yeah.
That's maximum insane. Effective for BAR, they say, it was 45 to 5,000, but again, you can't hit what you can't see. Although,
right. I would say at 5,000, you're using what we used to call plunging fire.
Yep.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's like area fire.
Yep.
You know, it's not point fire. But who gives a crap if I have 2,000 rounds per minute coming in on me?
If I'm throwing it out there that fast, I'm hitting something.
Yeah. Or at least keeping their heads down.
Yeah.
You're scaring someone if you're not hitting.
Oh yeah.
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 So they made up to 400,000 units between 1942 and 1945. The Germans did on the MG42.
Wow.
Whereas between 1918 and 1960, there was 351,000 units made.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's talk about the infantry tactics real quick before we have to go into the break. So both were squad automatic weapons designed to deliver suppressive fire. So, I mean, if you're an infantryman for any more than a second, you would realize that these are interlocking fields of fire.
Yep.
Obviously.
Precisely.
Would have to be. The BAR used walking fire during assaults. Obviously, the MG42 is not going to be carried during an assault, right? Because it's locked into its tripod and TNE and stuff. But I could imagine having two interlocking fields of fire on both sides of an infantry squad and those things going just alternating, you know, like, holy crap.
Yeah, you start doing talking.
And then if somebody yelled out, like, fire in the FPF,
yeah.
Right? That final protective fire. Oh, man, all bets are off then.
Have you fired one?
I have in Germany.
Okay.
For the Schussnachtschwere.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For the German marksmanship badge. So we got to go into a break. Mandatory break, I guess. Like, those things suck. It's like, but nonetheless, hey, stay tuned. We're going to continue on our conversation about the BAR and the MG42 compare and contrast with Colonel Montana Kid Hammer. And we got Matt in the room with us as well. Stay tuned. You'll be right back here with Chuck Indereen at Shooter's Corner. Welcome back, listeners. You're here with Chuck Indereen at Shooter's Corner. Remember, as always, if you've missed any part of the show or any of our past shows, always go to KFARradio.com, click on that link that says Shooter's Corner with Chuck Indereen, and scroll down to the archives, and you can listen to this show or any other past show as well. We're here in the studios with Matt and Colonel Montana Kid Hammer, and we're doing a compare-contrast between the Browning automatic rifle or the Browning machine gun rifle. Machine rifle and the MG42 that the Germans were using around circa 1942. But nonetheless, appreciate you staying tuned in here. So we talked about some of the tactics and stuff that the MG42 and the BAR were using. We pretty much came to the conclusion, based on history as well, that they were basically the anchors for any squad defense because we were using them for interlocking fields of fire or those kind of things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. One of the other things you need to know about these machine guns as well is they were never really on their own. Like, you never wanted to have a machine gun nest without somebody else that was, like, covering them, you know?
Absolutely.
Because they're just going to get circled and then hand grenades thrown in there.
Mm-hmm. But that was a tactic to flank, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about portability and sustained firepower.
Okay.
I thought that was also an interesting thing. You got this. So the BAR is lightweight, under 20 pounds, made it more maneuverable for a single soldier, ideal for mobile assaults or trench broom rolls in World War I style. However, its 20-round magazine limited burst of 3 to 4 seconds before reloading. That is incredibly low, if you think about it, like in a firefight.
You need a lot of machine guns to accurately suppress for a long time, or you link
that is
a lot
not
of belts together.
Thank you. That's, but you can't because it's box magazines.
Yeah, we're no, exactly. About the BAR that, and that's what I'm saying case. Is like you're very limited with that box mag, and you're if you're going full cyclic, just dumping the entire mag, sure. But
what do you think, Colonel? Like, done. Reloading.
You've learned and trained well to get magazines in and out of the gun. And like I said, you.
Were they drop free mags?
You tried to keep, you definitely tried to, you know, you wanted to keep your ammo bearers, you know, caught up with you so that you could virtually have that kind of ammunition.
And if the ammo bearer behind you got shot.
Oh, you're done.
You're screwed.
Yep.
I mean, and this was a thing that, you know, the French concept of walking fire up to the trench and then hosing it. Great in theory, but in delivery, like you said, once you tip that barrel over, even with a full magazine,
it was empty again.
Yeah, you were done before you started as such.
And I would have wished you had an M1 carbine at that point.
I could have wished you had a lot of other things, but not that.
Yeah. However, again, from the two books that I have you know, brought, let's say, let me flip back to my notes real quick.
Yeah, absolutely. But while you're doing that, I mean, by the contrast, the heavier MG-42, while less portable, requiring a crew of only two for optimal use, excelled in prolonged engagements with belt fed. Yeah. So they could go up to 250 rounds in a belt.
Yeah.
So that's equivalent to what we had with our machine guns as well, where we had 200-round drums for our saws, 200-round belts. Yep. You know, it's pretty much the standard anyways.
Right.
You know, unless you're in a Bradley, and then you can link together, what do we have?
Thousands of rounds.
Yeah, 2,500 rounds in our ready box.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I like my Huey. I had plenty of you know, for my pig, which was helicopter. You know, I carried it. I carried on the bird. And I just, at any rate, you know, Bloody Ridge and Beyond, a World War II talk about Guadalcanal. The Marines really came into their own in those battles, and whether it was the Modus or whether it, you know, was the M1 Grand, although again, many of them were still, he makes comment on how fast they can run those O3 bolt guns. But at any rate, the BAR certainly, you know, fit into it, but it was from there they learned add more BAR gunners, you know, to the mix.
Right.
And again, they could say and shoot the fire slower. I don't believe anybody ever said that. I believe they determined how they came up there on their adversary on how many rounds they were going to run, how quickly. But this is where their talking fire, which I want to say was Peleliu, or was it the battle before? They learned to put like 4 to 5 of them on a line, and one of them would bait. Or discover the ambush or bait
an enemy
pillbox.
Machine gun to open fire.
Yeah. And get 3 rounds off and get down. And when it was answered, the other 4 or 5 guns would take their turn at picking away. And if they didn't get the gun, you know, it would swivel and so on and so forth. But eventually, the 4 or 5 BARs would take them apart, which was something the Japanese, they thought their 1,000 rounds. A minute fire would be supreme on the battlefield. And not that it didn't do its job, but the Japanese and their Bushido code thought they would do more than they did.
Got to leave it up to the Americans to come up with this ingenious idea that, like, one guy kind of sacrifices himself to the pillbox, right?
Yep.
And the other guys are all like, okay, now you get down, and we're going to, like, pick at this dude like a little wolf pack. If you think about it, like, that's literally what we were doing. Like,
we do that all the time with
we
everything.
We do that. Yeah, we grab onto something by its heels, and then we just, like...
I mean, you look at when you're testing your chemical environment. Everyone's got a pro mask on. All right, lowest rank or least like guy. Take
this
that
is
off.
A different. This isn't it, the, it's same. The same.
It
no,
is the same.
Not.
You're going to have an acceptable loss for the greater good. That's what it is. Yeah.
But this isn't necessarily a loss. This is just a guy who's like throwing some fire out there, waiting for a response, and then everybody just shoots back at said response. Yep. This is not demasking procedures in an NBC environment. You know, great idea.
As I
sound like you're French.
I may have mentioned, it's really the banana wars where the Marines particularly.
Is that because the price of bananas went up too high?
Evidently.
Where was this at? Yeah. Put us in context. What do you mean by the banana wars?
The banana wars were Nicaragua, Central America.
Sandinistas?
Not quite
the
them yet, but I'm sure the descendants thereof.
Sure.
Cuba, Mexico, Cuba. A part of that. Now the Army does a fair amount of the banana war, quote unquote, in 1916, Pershing and Patton. But this is after the Great War, and we're back at in Central America, but still nobody's had the kind of, there's no MG-42 or a 34 to answer it. So they develop what they can, they charge forward with it, but it's when they start, and for a lot of people think that the Americans won World War II or turned the tide at Midway. That was not even the case. We barely hung on to Guadalcanal, but it's where the exception is Wake Island, but so far the Japanese had a free run of things, and so the Americans had to begin to take these firearms and develop tactics, especially when you've got a 20-round box magazine. The exception to that was the 40-round box magazine that was put on a BAR if they had it on a stand for anti-aircraft. But I've never found one, not to stand the 40-round magazine. I won't say they're not that prolific.
It was because it was left on a battlefield somewhere.
Yeah.
The supply chain had to suck for that. You have to look up real quick. I mean, we got a few seconds here, but look up and see what the standard issue was for BAR. Was it one rifle each, one bipod, and 4,700 magazines? You know what I mean? I could understand the supply guys. I just issued you two magazines yesterday. What happened to them?
How'd you lose them already?
Yeah. But nonetheless, let's talk about this real quick because I thought this was interesting. The construction of them. The milled steel construction was precise, labor-intensive for the BAR, right? But the MG-42 was stamped sheet and spot-welded, so they could literally 75 hours to make an MG-42 versus 150 hours to make the MG-34. So they actually cut their cost by 44% and materials by half, which was crucial for Germany's wartime shortages at that time.
Yeah, absolutely.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
But it also made the MG-42 cheaper versus the BAR's high equivalent. But it made it noisier and also ammo hungry.
Yeah.
So
when I created the article that we're working from, my hope was not necessarily to sell. It's the best rifle ever. Da 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 da. It's just that it's a Browning first of all, and second of all, in capable hands under the right kind of logistics, it's still a very functional firearm in the 21st century. Now, I can say that because I read a lot of books, I watch a lot of TV and YouTube. I've never carried one in combat. And I've never humped it over hill and dale. Right. I certainly didn't have to fight it at 50 below.
All right, we got to go into a break here. There, Colonel. All right, so when we come back from our break, we're going to continue on this conversation and compare and contrast between the MG-42 and the BAR. Kind of like moving up now into more modern eras, but stay tuned here with us. Chuck Indereed in Shooter's Corner, KFAR 97.5, 660 AM. Welcome back, listeners. You're here with Chuck Indereed in Shooter's Corner here at KFAR Studios in Fairbanks, Alaska. You're listening to us probably on 97.5 or 660 AM. Remember, you can always listen to us live at KFARradio.com. Click on that big orange ball that says Listen Live. And also, guess what? You can listen to us on the app. Yeah, that's right. There's a KFAR app where you can listen live to KFAR 97.5 live. It's amazing. Science, right? Cool. We're here with Colonel Montana Kid Hammer here in the studio, and we have Matt, as always. We are talking about the compare and contrast between the BAR and the MG-42 and when they met each other on the battlefields. And then also interesting conversations about how the BAR kind of migrated itself over into the Pacific theater as well. So you mentioned, Colonel, about the Guadalcanal, right?
Yeah, precisely. That's where the Marines, well, it's where our armed forces begin, because the Army will come as well, and it's where we really first meet the Japanese. They're there to build an airstrip and keep the passage between Australia and Honolulu.
Hold on. I got to say this real quick, though. So you said the Marines had the BAR? Didn't the Army originally have it?
They both will have them, yes.
Oh, simultaneously. Yeah, so this wasn't a hand-down to the Marines from some Navy thing.
No. Yeah, in fact,
this might be one of the only times.
Might be one of the only times that's ever happened. That's amazing.
The Marines back in 1920s procure them, along with the Thompson and stuff. So, yes,
nice. They have smart them. Of them then. Yeah. We're just hand-downs from some, like, Kentucky National Guard or something to the Marines.
However, they don't end up with the M1 Grands as early, in the Pacific War. But
What did they have then?
They had the O-3 Springfields, and you were talking about a bolt rifle and it being slow. In fact, Whitey Goff speaks about that in his book on Bloody Ridge, that those Marines, not only were they dead accurate, they could run that bolt gun. I mean, the thing that hurt them wasn't the 20-round magazine. It was the 5-round stripper clip. But nonetheless, the Marines didn't lack for firepower, but the BARs, now again, at Guadalcanal, they wouldn't be as numerous in August, September of 42 as they will become. Yet the Marines will fight all the way across, to Iwo Jima and beyond.
But I find it interesting because, like, you were talking about the BAR and stuff like that, and we're talking about the Marines and everything, and I'm looking at the cover of this book, The Bloody Ridge and Beyond, right, written by Whitey Marlin, Whitey Groft, right? And what's interesting, though, is it's Marines on a rib, literally an inflatable boat.
Mm-hmm.
And the dude who's on the bow is there with a BAR.
Yes.
That's pretty cool.
Whitey talks about how they train that way and so on and so forth along the East Coast, Chesapeake Bay area before they go off to more fun digs at all. But
There's not enough pictures in this book, though.
Not near enough, yes.
And it's not in Crayon. That's interesting. He was a Marine.
Mm. I hate reading words.
There's got to be a video on that somewhere.
I don't want to give the impression that, the Marines had the end-all to be-all with the BAR. They did very much in the Pacific to start, but their Army compatriots catch up. And then, of course, little or nothing for Marines in Europe. And this is where, of course, the Germans and the Italians in North Africa and later on their Booty Peninsula meet the BAR in the hands of the Army. So if listeners former Army, but he acts about the Marines. No, the BAR was evenly spread out among many, but the 351,000 eventually being produced. It's just each segment fought their adversary in different ways, especially when you had to come up against your buzzsaw, Hitler's buzzsaw.
That's because the tactics in the Pacific theater are, obviously weren't the same as they were in the European theater.
Yeah.
So. Totally different enemy.
Only slightly, because bullets are going back and forth between,
Well, that and you didn't have the Germans burrowing into an area either, like a mountain.
Or
per se. They did in some areas with an insane tunnel system like the Japanese were doing
Iwo
Jima.
Yeah. A volcano that they burrow into where it's like 120, 140 degrees inside the rock that they're defending, and there's no water on the island. Chichijima has water, but which is an island north, but Iwo Jima does not have water. If it doesn't, it isn't brought in, you don't have it.
I didn't think about that.
That
like
sucks.
Burrowing into a volcano.
Nope.
Like, who's the poor jackalope that hit the molten lava? Like, I guess I didn't go down
some,
that far.
Some 4'3" guy that was just burning alive.
In his white loincloth.
He was saved from the BAR by molten lava. But
could poach their fish down in there without even...
So, the Marines definitely develop it in the Pacific for what they have to do in their, you know, jungle fighting and the immense heat and humidity and so on and so forth, Guadalcanal, initially about all the water they had was in their canteens. And there's a story about a Mod Deuce, but we'll save that for another time.
Yeah, Mod Deuce is an entirely different segment.
Yes, totally.
She deserves her own space in time.
What gets done there, again, so typically Marine Corps.
You had an article. Sorry, you had an article in there about, because I kind of want to stay on the, the Marine Corps, did they use BARs to guard the mail?
They did with O3s and 1911s and shotguns. In fact, if you leaf through there, you'll see all the different firearms that the Marines, brought to the ball. There were a couple of Marines that were killed.
This was so amazing.
Yep.
That was so amazing. The way people just like lose their minds right now that the military is like, you know, going into towns and stuff. We kind of talked about it on another break, but it was like, I remember in the 70s, the National Guard going into Detroit in M113s. Mm-hmm. Like, I had a squad leader in the 80s who was actually on that deployment.
That's crazy.
Yeah, 82nd Airborne. God. I'm sorry. So it wasn't even the National Guard. It was the 82nd Airborne who went into Detroit at one time in M113s with 50 cals mounted and all that other kind of stuff because of the riots that they were having there, right? And now people lose their minds if, what, they see a train driving down the tracks with Bradley's on it going to a train.
We're going to war.
Oh, no, my God. They're mobilizing.
A bunch of poor dudes going to sit in the desert for 30 days.
Yeah, it's Jade Helm.
And really quick, before I forget to you, we talked about the BAR and its capacity and all that and what they would be carrying during that time. So a standard soldier that was using the
BAR. Oh, yeah, that's
a good info. A BAR gunner was using 6 magazines just on his person himself. He also had a sling. He had a hip support belt so he could fire from the hip when doing walking fire, plus spare parts kits, yada, 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 all that.
Hold on. Is that cup thing you were talking about?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the crazy part is, which I feel so sorry for their assistant bar team members is what they were called, which essentially is just your ammo bearer. That guy was carrying 48 magazines, BAR mags, with a single BAR magazine weighing 1.7 pounds, fully loaded. That means that ammo bearer is carrying 81 pounds, roughly 82 pounds of just ammunition. And that's at a minimum. That's what they were issued at any point in time. So you had, 48? So that's 54 magazines at any given time for that BAR, but only 6 on the gunner itself.
Fighting for your life. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I was leafing through this thing.
Yeah.
Because I'm absolutely enamored by these Remington Model 10 trench gun and this Winchester 1897 trench gun.
So for another time.
Yeah, I know. So I went on to Gun Broker and found a rarest U.S. Remington Model 10 trench gun, 10A, World War I, 12 gauge shotgun, $19,000.
Yeah.
And I imagine if it's on GunBroker, that means that it is that's not the auctionable ones. So there is probably some out there that are $40,000, $50,000, $60,000.
May I throw out?
It's actually a really nice looking gun, though.
Yes, it is very nice.
Oh wow!
May I throw out real quick?
Yeah,
before we close, is
and then also, Kid Hammer, Frank Hammer, your distant relative, used a BAR to do what?
Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah, exactly.
1934. Real quick, Rock in a Hard Place is a book by James Ballou on the Browning automatic rifle. It's about the best know-it-all book you'll find if they're interested.
They probably find that on Amazon or something.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. All right. Thank you, listeners, staying with us the entire duration here at Shooter's Corner, KFAR Studios. Remember, you can always listen to us at 97.5 every Thursday from 11 to 12. Also, you can always go to our archives and listen to the shows that we've done in the past. And also, you can always listen live to us as well if you happen to be traveling. So we really appreciate you staying tuned with us here. Our discussion on the BAR and the MG42. Drive safe and enjoy your week.